Welcome to Writer's Voice. This is Daisy Mathias.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later in the show, we'll bring you an interview with journalist Nicholas Basbains about his new book, Every Book Its Reader.
But first, we talk with poet Carol Edelstein.
Carol Edelstein is this year's winner of the Perugia Press Intro Award, which is given to a promising woman poet for the publication of her first or second book of poetry. Edelstein lives within a mile of where she was born in Northampton. Her first book, The World Is Round, was published in 1994. She's published fiction, essays and poems in magazines and anthologies, including The Denver Quarterly, Georgia Review, Alaska Quarterly Review, and Flash Fiction. Edelstein leads writing workshops and organizes a reading series that features local writers. Edelstein's book is called The Disappearing Letters. Well, Carol Edelstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
We want to say we enjoy your poetry very, very much.
I'm delighted to be here, and good. I'm delighted that you have the book in your hand.
You know, we invited you on because you won the 2005, is that right? 2005
yes.
Perugia Intro Award. And we've had wonderful success with previous winners of the mm-hmm. award. Last year it was Diane Gilliam Fisher. What led you to apply for this, and how was that process? Maybe just tell us a little bit about that to begin with.
Well, the process started because I took a manuscript class with Susan Cann and Gail Thomas, who are Perugia Press, and they were very encouraging to me and gave me a lot of tips on how to put my manuscript together and encouraged me to enter it in their contest and other contests.
What's a manuscript class?
It's a class where it was really a way to give the people who signed up a chance to think about not the individual poems and a critique on the individual pieces, but how to put the pieces together into a grouping that was appealing and made sense and made musical sense in some way.
So your book, The Disappearing Letters, you have divided up into different sections. Did they come out of that class then?
Not directly, but very much indirectly, because the original manuscript was organized quite differently than this. And I did a lot of thinking and rearranging and physical rearranging in the manuscript after taking this class from them.
So you put poems in a different order, for example?
A radically different order.
Can you capsulize the difference? Or
I guess mainly what was different is that my original organization was thematic. And their suggestion to me, and it wasn't a suggestion they made to everybody, but their suggestion for my manuscript was that I mix it up a little bit more.
So these, you have a section called Hieroglyphs, another one, Seeing Double, and Good Old Moon. So do the poems that are in them, how do they correspond to those titles of those sections?
In a very wild, intuitive way, I actually spread the poems out on the floor of a big room and wandered around and tried many, many different orders until I came up with the order that I've got. So it's very hard to describe what my thinking was, because I was actually moving from piece to piece to put it together.
And so originally you would had, say, all the mother poems together or all the lost poems together, and then you spread them out and integrated them?
Yes.
Yes.
And I looked more for pulling threads that were different together. I mean, in the way that I suppose someone working in fibers would try to make a color plan that you have to play with the colors.
Or a mixed bouquet rather
yes.
than just all roses in this
yes.
all lilacs in that one. Yeah.
Before we began this interview and we were talking a little bit, we all kind of came to the notion, well, we all kind of came in with the notion that we'd really like you to do a lot of reading of these wonderful poems here.
That's what I want to do.
And Daisy, you just mentioned a couple of themes. I wonder if you have some poems you would like to ask Carol to read.
Well, I really liked Illness Lifting and Poems for My Mother. I love both of those.
I wonder if you could do that Illness Lifting, because I actually did want to ask
that
you.
One.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the theme of illness, too, after you read the poem.
illness lifting. This morning, it seems my little city becomes pale, blurry. Bedpost, bureau, glass of water, furrowed brow of the window onto blue-black pine. I can't clearly see any of it. Even my own hands have lost their outlines, appear to slowly melt. I lay them on my face. They are warm, whole. And here are all my beautiful indentations, eye sockets, cheekbones, brow, hollows of my temples, and the two symmetrical notches, slight along the lines of my jaw. I am still completely myself. This melting and blurring, then, must be my soul's condition. I close my eyes. I want to speak purely, without one word or picture. I remember my first long, watery ride. How she moved me through the dark. How I listened, grew teeth and hair, kicked. How I began to want.
I love the way you segue so effortlessly from the real and particular into the vision, which continues to remain real and particular.
Thank you.
What do you mean by that?
It's as if you take us from the bedroom into the womb with just one step.
Mm-hmm. Hey, yeah. You got it.
Well, illness does seem to be a theme in your poetry, or at least in this book. And you also treat it, it seems, from perhaps your own perspective, but also other people that you know, unless those other people are really you. I don't know mm-hmm. that. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that. What is illness as a metaphor or as a reality for you?
I think it's both. And the poems in this book that have to do with illness are from very particular experiences with people close to me and of my own, of when the body's in a compromised place mm-hmm. and how that changes everything about how you see and what you expect and what you appreciate.
Well, I wonder if you could, there was another poem here that also had to do with illness. I need to find it, actually. Here it is. She answers the question I dare not ask.
She answers the question I dare not ask. Until today, she's been determined to resume her old life, nothing less. Half measures, she is merely tolerated. Surgeries, medicines, our earnest reports from office and garden, our soups, murmured prayers, lit candles. I claim she's been growing prize tomatoes since before she was born. She says that's an exaggeration, that she was 5 when for a school assignment she grew her first bean from seed in a paper cup. Because I am writing this down, my version may be the one to live on. However, she is correct that she has refused to loosen her grip. Too much to do. But this morning when I gave her the ocean in my long look, I think she saw it might be all right not to learn the hula or how to speak Chinese. I think she began to believe she could go out hungry, watching clouds.
Do you want to share who this was or what she was like and who she meant to you?
Well, this is a poem that I wrote for my friend Robin Otten, who would say, this poem is entirely fiction. And she would be right about that, but I hope that it is very true, and I think she would say it is.
So she wasn't ill?
She was very ill, and she was very well while she was very ill. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I am fascinated by in terms of writing about illness, about how people are so themselves inside of great distress.
Especially illnesses that don't disease the mind.
That's right.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voice, where we're interviewing Carol Edelstein about her book of poetry, The Disappearing Letters.
I have to say that You have themes like illness and death, and the other theme that I wanted to ask you about was death, and yet there was really nothing that was depressing about reading these poems at all. So I think that that's kind of a feat. They managed to really strike into the heart and elucidate the beauty of a situation or a question or just a wondering. You had one about somebody who committed suicide. Failures of Alchemy, which really also struck me. And, you know, I found a lot of these poems really told stories more than, you know, a lot of poems may comment on a certain kind of thought or idea or observe, but your poems really tell stories. I wanted to know more about these people, what happened. Not that I needed it to be in a poem, but I was looking forward to the opportunity of asking you, who was this person? And what was this all about, and why did you choose to write about this? And for example, Failures of Alchemy, which perhaps you'd like to read first.
Failures of Alchemy. In the pearl of this April morning, I have just learned of your death. You are freshly dead, hours gone, without yet the shelter of wood, earth, or cleansing consumptive fire. How could you have hanged yourself from a wooden beam when the lilac bush in your own yard was just getting dressed, and your youngest daughter's flock of memories will have to land during each migration exactly here? I must mix animal stone with vegetable liqueur. I must send the soul of Saturn whirling into an oily clot. None of us will say we knew you well. Not now. Did you think we'd know you better if you put a stop to conversation? Or if, at the pond's putrefying edges, you ceased finding beauty? I know you once found it there, for you rendered wings and filaments, fronds and pods, cilia so delicate they required you load your color onto a brush made of only three hairs. When I was 20 and not so sure it was good to live, you were the man who stood by the completed painting, placed a magnifying glass in my hand, and said, "Look what I made." Where were you last night? Your answer better be good. I mean, I want to hear you mixed leafy water with leathery water and drank it down under the fattest moon, thinking it was the sturdy donkey who would carry you like a load of salt to the sea. Perhaps I'm casting nonsense spells to prove nothing can bring you back. I'm afraid I will always fault you for not trying hard enough. Why didn't you try burnt copper with blackened copper? A thick slash of blue in the upper left, something hammered in or stuck on with glue, shards of glass, old cutlery, anything at all. You, of all people, knew how full this world is of matter to break and fix, melt down, build up. It didn't have to be new. Couldn't you have set out to duplicate any one of the old recipes, or simply rested into this milky light that comes even when nobody calls?
I guess before I want to ask you anything about it, I'd like to say you express perfectly the kind of frustration and, you know, the bewilderment that is left when somebody that you really care about make that choice against all the slings and arrows of this life that we all have to face, you know. And so I want to thank you for that, because I think it was just a very real poem, a very real invitation and to feel and to say what is often so difficult to feel and say.
You certainly got what I am trying to do with this poem, which is to express the very strange mixture of emotions when you lose a person this way who is so talented and who, you know, at some point in time knows how to see beauty in a way that many people don't.
And also that sense of did I really know this person? Yeah. If they could do this, that was so simply, directly expressed. Mm-hmm. I think it really struck a note. Another note, I would love for you, because some of your poems are so joyous and, mm-hmm. and light and tripping.
Get on to another theme here.
I would love for you to read Why This Happiness.
Why this happiness? Why do the lovers walk, jump, dance on the unmade bed? Last night she dreamed of a goat grazing on the tough blue weeds by the gully and woke to the rhythmic sounds of her own chewing. He dreamed he opened a suitcase and found there a clean shirt just his size, a neatly rolled pair of socks, and a real weather front, cumulonimbus clouds which rose up, expanded, and actually rained in their little attic room. "How do you say lightning in French?" he asked her. "It could be bon voyage," she said. "It could be petit déjeuner." She was laughing. She stood up and started to jump. "It could be pomme de terre. Now you know all my French." "It rained in my dream, mademoiselle," he said. "Were you already awake?" He stood up then, too, and walked around her while she jumped.
That's such a lovely poem.
Another theme, if I can say that there are themes in the book, is putting together the history of a person, not in the sense of recounting the history, but of the different stages of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mother as a child, or the father as a child, or your mother and then thinking of yourself as an adult and as a child. Kind of all the layers of time that are seen or that you're looking at once. Am I describing it correctly?
Very, very well. It's one of the things that I think poetry is so well suited to, is conveying, because it's such a compressed form of expression, and conveying the complicated array of selves that we are.
Right. And so there's a couple of poems I thought of with that.
There's an Emerson poem which talks about the killer and the victim being the same person. And I feel like you are your parents and your parents are you, and yet you're not your parents. And it layers up, doesn't it?
I think they would agree with you, too.
What might be some poems on that theme that you would like to read?
There's Yellow Comb.
Yellow Comb. Yellow Comb at the end of the world. Again, she says that word, baby, places my hand where I can feel the kick, my brother. Her belly so big with him, she cannot bend for what's dropped, what's slipped from her fingers while she's trying to make me a neat side part. Pick it up, dear, won't you? Never before had I moved for her as slowly as I moved then, to pluck from the blue linoleum that comb.
We're talking with Carol Edelstein about her book of poetry, The Disappearing Letters. Do you sometimes find that a metaphor is completely clear to you, but not clear to someone else? I know in one poem you said, "The night sky is not as I had assumed self-explanatory." And I wondered if sometimes people say to you, "Well, that's interesting, but what does it mean?" Do you ever get that?
Yes. I think you're always, if you're writing poetry, you're always at the risk of being misunderstood, maybe more so than in any other writing form, mm-hmm. because there's at least in my experience, I'm always trying to pare down what I'm saying to leave the least amount of words and to have as much weight in each one as can be done. Mm-hmm. That's not everybody's style, and it's not always my style, but it generally is, and when I'm revising, that's what I work at.
Mm-hmm. And do you do a lot of revising?
A lot.
Well, here's two more that I'd love you to read. First was When You Think You Cannot Sleep.
Yes.
Because I thought that was really delightful.
When you think you cannot sleep, get into position anyway and count by twos. At 100, cast an iron bell and crawl under it, where God the Father is a crack of light and Mother sings our way to school. Did you know all of us once were children together, dawdling over our breakfast, kicking feet under the table, late whenever we lingered at the flat rock, our barge along the Nile, so someone could be Cleopatra, someone Mark Antony, waiting for a kiss. Falling asleep is not so different from falling in love. Head drops back, fingers and lips open. Anger, like sugar in tea, dissolves. Even the rope of worry goes slack. Through dark pines and tall grasses you're striding, through the thickness of your own tongue, to your first words, said and sung.
The images that you bring forward here, I mean, of course, that's the stuff of poetry, is to bring together images that surprise and make people really think. But yours are, there's a playfulness, especially in this one, and things that I would have never thought. I mean, cast an iron bell and crawl under it, where God the Father is a crack of light and Mother sings our way to school. I mean, right there, that just, that evokes childhood so perfectly. What's the iron bell?
Well, I think probably everybody has the iron bell that's in the Liberty Bell that's in their school book.
That has the crack in it.
That has a crack in it. Right. But I don't really know how that insinuated itself.
It's a safe place.
Yes. And it's tent-like.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's rooted in our history.
And it's heavy.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's very, very mysterious how these things kind of pop in, and then how to weave them so they feel accessible to somebody else.
There's one called Purely Speculative.
Mm-hmm. That was nice.
Would you like me to read it?
Yeah, but I'd love the line about the old bed where it's restful and exciting in turns with a picture window on all the early mistakes. Mm. That's really weaving the past with the present. Yes. Read the whole thing for us.
Purely Speculative. The end isn't water in its unsteady states, isn't oil, isn't gold, isn't pure in its purest form. The end isn't flames or curlicue flight. The end isn't the overpowering odor of roses, a great escape or a grand entrance. We can wait together here in our beat-up old bed, where it's restful and exciting in turns, with a picture window on all the early mistakes. He'll skip the small talk, won't knock. The end, I'll wager, will barge right in on short, sturdy legs, calling up until we haul him to us. We have to. He's this irresistible. If we're lucky, if I'm right, he'll be the baby we would have had if we'd had one, hungry again, just doing his job, hungry for milk and a grip on the nipple, hungry to fall into the world's deepest lake. We'll think he has your eyes and my hands, but we'll have no idea where he got that smile.
I couldn't decide whether the end was the end of life or the end of this relationship or what exactly it was.
Well, I have my own thoughts about that, but I would like not to close off any of those possibilities. I wanted this poem to work in several different ways. So I'm pleased to hear that you didn't quite know which one to land on.
Is it only just those two, or could it be more?
There's actually at least one more that I've heard of from readers.
That's great. And my final one was Just Here.
This is a villanelle. It's maybe the most formal poem in this book.
What did you say?
It's written in a form called a villanelle.
What is that?
It's a very old structure for a poem, using particular line breaks and rhyme scheme. Just Here. I wasn't made for this world. I was made for another. I have asked for wings and a new name and a flat stone to skim across the river. I sing to the thistles. They don't answer. Under the umbrella tree, after the sudden rain, I wasn't made for this world. I was made for another. Where does it go, the love I can't recover? It trips like night into the slippery dark day. Here's the flat stone I'll skim across the river. These heart sounds cover what I know but cannot say. I wasn't made for this world. I was made for another. The engine pressing air and wonder through root and reed, through flame, flies the stone I'll skim across the river. The heat of your tongue, your familiar skin, tempts me to stay. But I wasn't made for this world. I was made for another. Here's the flat stone I'll skim across the river.
Well, Carol Edelstein, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
I am very honored to be here. And I also want to give a big thank you to Susan Cann of Perugia Press, who is an absolutely devoted champion of poetry, of women and women writers. And I have so enjoyed collaborating with her to get this book out.
And we're so glad that she's in this area.
Yes. I'm so delighted that you could come and talk with us today and read some of your poems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Poet Carol Edelstein. Francesca, you interviewed Nicholas Basbanes last week. Tell us about him.
Well, I did, Daisy. Literary journalist Nicholas Basbanes is a self-described bibliomane. He wrote a book several years ago called A Gentle Madness, which describes the malady of bibliomania, an excessive love of books.
We know a little bit about that.
We do. He's also written other books about books, including perhaps his best known, A Splendor of Letters. He's just published Every Book Its Reader, The Power of the Printed Word to Stir the World.
Well, welcome Nicholas Basbanes to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
I really enjoyed this very complex, actually, and detailed, fascinating book about the impact of books on people.
Thank you.
You say at the beginning of chapter 4 that the idea that people are products of the things they read, that they are to a great extent shaped by their books, is an endlessly fascinating notion to consider. Now, spell out for us a little bit the fascination that propelled you to this subject.
Well, I've written 4 earlier books about books. A Gentle Madness, 1995, 10 years ago, which was kind of a 2,500-year appreciation of bibliomania, the madness for books. Then I did a book called Patience and Fortitude, which I have to explain as because I was once introduced at a speaker's function as Nick Basbanes, author of Gentle Madness and Pride and Prejudice, that it's not a Jane Austen novel, but the names of the lions in front of the New York Public Library. So that was my library book, and then I had a book called A Splendor of Letters, which dealt with any number of book issues. Books I've done, and then another book called Among the Gently Mad, which was another book about collecting. So I've written about bibliomania, bibliophilia, biblioclasm, every manner of book issue book, about, really celebrating the book as artifact. It seemed appropriate in this fifth book to write a book about ultimately what are books for. Obviously, they're for readers. And so this, you ask what propelled me to write this book, it was really to celebrate the book in its purest form, the book as a conveyor of information, of entertainment, of wisdom, of inspiration, all of these things that books do. And, of course, being a literary journalist, as I fancy myself, everything I write is driven by narrative storytelling, and I thought it would be very interesting because I've spent 30 years interviewing every manner of person, and certainly the last 25 or so writing about authors and book people, to try and locate and interview people I regard as some of the most brilliant readers of our time, and that indeed does make up, I think, the major thrust of this new book, Every Book Its Readers. It just seemed like a natural, normal, reasonable extension of my work as an author.
A literary journalist, what is that?
Yeah, what is that? I guess it's a nonfiction writer who specializes in writing about books and book people, because prior to writing what is now my fifth book about books and literature, I also had worked as a literary editor for the Worcester Telegram, and in fact syndicated myself, and featuring literary profiles, what I like to regard as literary features of major authors. I think I did more than 1,000 of these over a 22-year period. So I'm all constantly writing about literary themes, be they book themes or book-related themes. And so I guess the phrase I coined to describe myself is literary journalist, because I've written really hundreds, perhaps thousands of pieces of journalism for newspapers and for magazines about book-related subjects, and have written 5 books on book-related subjects.
So is A Gentle Madness bibliomania?
The subtitle of A Gentle Madness is Bibliophiles, Bibliomanes, meaning maniacs, mm-hmm. and the Eternal Passion for Books.
Wonderful.
And that was my first book, was published in 1995, and it was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm pleased to say it was a New York Times notable book. And it was a phrase I coined. I'm very proud of it. And it's almost used. It's not quite hasn't achieved the cachet of Catch 22, shall we say? But it is my phrase. I mean, it is the gentle madness of bibliomania. I was inspired to coin that phrase by a description given of Isaiah Thomas, an 18th century bibliophile and printer and publisher and firebrand patriot, whose great collection formed the core of the American Antiquarian Society here in Worcester, which is the first of a uniquely American kind of a library established by a book collector, and which continues to operate independently of any educational institution. Others would be the Morgan Library in New York, the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, the Huntington Library in California. There are a number of them. All of these great institutions are the product of what I describe as the gentle madness of bibliomania. And when Thomas died in the, he was 83 or 84 years old, a grandson said in tribute, he said, "Grandfather was afflicted early by the gentlest of infirmities. He was a bibliomaniac." And I'll never forget when I saw that description of him. I said, there's the title for my book.
Wonderful. Now, you begin with your book with a lovely story about a woman named Catherine Hilliard Young.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I love that story.
Yeah, well, tell us about her and say a little bit about why you chose to put the story at the beginning of this book.
I wanted, you know, here I am interviewing people like Elaine Pagels and Robert Fagels and Robert Coles and Helen Vendler and David McCullough, Harold Bloom. I mean, people that I think are immediately recognizable to discriminating readers throughout the United States, people who can talk at great length about how books have impacted their lives in a variety of different genres. I mean, we talk about poetry, we talk about religious texts. But here is a woman who, from 80 or 85 years ago, from the early years of the 20th century, who's undoubtedly unknown today, and she was a simple woman who lived in central Pennsylvania, and she lived on a farm, and she wrote a letter to a woman named May Lamberton Becker, who herself, I think, today is probably unknown, but in her day was probably the Oprah Winfrey of the book world. She wrote columns for the New York Evening Post and later the Saturday Review of Literature, and they were called Reader's Guide. They were her Reader's Guide columns for both of these publications, and she had enormous influence. And she received a letter from this woman who identified herself as RFD, Rural Farm Delivery, and she really didn't have the funds to buy much in the way of reading. She couldn't, because she lived out in farm country. And the horses were always needed on the farm. She couldn't get to the public library, so she asked Mrs. Becker. She said, "If you had 4 books to recommend that I buy this year, what four can't-miss books would you recommend for me to buy? Well, I mean, I know if I had received such a letter, and undoubtedly, as you will see when you read the book, that May Lambert and Becker responded in the same way. This is a great story, and she began corresponding with the woman, but she also wrote a column, and she invited her readers. Well, what four books would you recommend that this woman buy, and what four books would you recommend that she read this year? And it just kind of initiated a flurry of correspondence, and it just touched the readers of this magazine. And of course, the subtext, when something she never told her readers, was that the woman was very ill. I mean, she doesn't identify the illness, but from what you can divine from what you read, there is that the woman must have had cancer and she was dying. And there was one book that she particularly wanted to read before she left this earth, and she confided it to Mrs. Becker, and she used she moved heaven and earth, it seems to me, to contact the publisher and to get an early review copy of this book for the woman to read before she passed away. And I just thought this was a wonderful, accessible, moving story that I could use as the entry point for this new book. I mean, we talk about how books impact these great readers that I've identified and profiled within the pages of this book, but I also wanted to begin in a way that would resonate with every kind of reader. Just a little simple story about a person now lost to history, has been dead for perhaps 80 years or so, since the 1920s, and yet how does reading and how did reading impact and affect, influence her life? And I thought that was a nice way, a very moving way for me in any case, to enter this book.
Yes, it's
going on it.
It certainly was. And but there are also a lot of very fascinating parts of the book that have to do with the process of reading. And I'd like to start with marginalia.
Marginalia. Exactly.
First of all, as an inveterate marginalist myself.
You are.
Yes.
Don't tell any librarians. You
know, but, I don't do it on library books.
Well, of course. But it's very interesting, you know, because that is one of the interests that I have in this book, and it's kind of comprises the opening five chapters, not just marginalia, but again, what one of the devices that we talk about how books shape lives. Are we the product of what we read?
Right. It's really the dialogue between the reader and the subject. And, you know, it reminds me of something that someone that I'm writing about now is a scholar of the Italian Renaissance who died in a German concentration camp in 1944. I came across something he said. He said, all history is a dialogue between the living and the dead.
Wow.
And when I first read that in his diary, my picture in my mind was him writing in the margins.
Boy, I wish I had that quote. I'd have used it. It's a wonderful quote.
Isn't it?
Oh, it's fabulous.
Writing in the margins of the historical texts he was reading, and I ended up writing in the margins of my copy of his diary.
Wow.
So it's a kind of viral process, if I can use...
It is. It's a very interesting way to approach it, but... We are. I think we're so fortunate that when we have, say, the books of Coleridge. I mean, Princeton University Press has published eight volumes of his marginalia. You know, I mean,
wow.
And what it really constitutes a form of a holographic manuscript. I mean, it's certainly, I think, is the equal of anything that you'd find in notebooks. I mean, obviously, the manuscripts of the essays and the books that Coleridge wrote would be by far the most important scholarly materials left behind. But these annotations, this marginalia, and in fact, he introduced that word. I mean, he didn't invent it, but he didn't coin that the word marginalia. But he really did identify the writings that he jotted into the margins of his books as marginalia, and in fact, he certainly expected that they would be collected. But Coleridge is really the singular example of the person who who writes in copies of his or her books, but Voltaire was also an amazing, marginalist, I guess.
I know. Well, there, you
I
can
like
have
the
a
word.
Pun on
it's certainly the person who does it. I pointed out that if Voltaire hadn't written, there's an expression that we associate with him, and it is, if God didn't exist, we would have to invent him.
And that was in the margins.
That's in the margin of a book. So that's just one example that comes to mind. Among our chief executives, our presidents of the United States, John Adams, David McCullough, of course, has written most eloquently about Adams and is a great champion of Adams. Adams was also a great writer of marginalia. His library of books is now at the Boston Public Library, and was very useful to David McCullough. He's one of the people I profile in every book as reader, and he of course is of the firm belief that it's not enough to just go and try and read every single document, every piece of correspondence that an historical figure has left, but to read the books that they have read. He said you really cannot understand or appreciate a person from any century unless not only do you know the books that they've read, but to have read the books that they, if you can possibly do this, the books that they've read. He said he really did that when he was working on his biography of John Adams.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Nicholas Bazbains about his new book, Every Book, Its Reader. Well, talking about the classification of presidents by their reading or getting to know them by their reading. You know, there are a lot of jokes going around in that vein about the reading habits of our current president.
Yeah, I stayed away from that book. I mean, it was just, dare I say, it was just too easy.
It was too easy picking.
Too easy.
Yeah. But you know
what is there to say about that?
Well, you know, it's funny because I Googled the phrase Bush's reading habits,
yeah,
and I got 1,000.
Kind of an oxymoron, isn't it?
Possibly.
I'll say that for the record too.
But what was interesting, I got 1,630 hits. So it's obviously this idea that you understand somebody by how they read is something that's shared by a lot of people.
I think so, and in his case, what you don't read.
Right.
I mean, I will say this: I found it very interesting when this, when the incumbent was president, was going off for his very long vacation in Crawford, Texas, this summer. That his press office put out a list of the three books that he was taking with him to read.
Mm-hmm.
The three books for 5 weeks. I mean,
yeah,
and. I found it fascinating that they would have to go to these lengths to put out a press release about what books. One wonders if this was an attempt to rehabilitate the image that he has as a person who is reported to have said once that he never read a book, you know, while he was going to Yale. And
it's pretty shocking, huh?
Pretty shocking.
Yeah. You know, just to move on a bit, I also loved your section on translation. A couple of things that you said were very that really struck me. One is how the original is always fresh, but that translations themselves are really pegged to their particular era. And I found that to be true because I've been looking at the Gutenberg project on the web, where you can read books that no longer are in
public domain.
That are in the public domain, exactly. And the translations are also usually quite old, and they don't quite fit the same way as more up-to-date ones. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the whole thrust of that chapter, when you think of the Western tradition and the classics, I mean, I know I'm good in one language, which is English. So really, if I'm going to read the Iliad or the Odyssey or the Aeneid or Proust, even, although I think you can kind of, if you have some French, you can try Proust in the original French, and with its great rewards. But Kafka, you have to rely on the intervention of a translator. And I don't know if there's a percentage, but when you think of the great works that come to us in the Western tradition, I'll bet 40, 50, 60, 70% of it comes by way of what another person has determined is the text that we receive. So again, I thought when I was dealing with a book that I titled Every Book, Its Reader, this whole idea of translation was a pertinent subject to do, which explains why I have that long profile of Robert Fagles, and then I follow with Breon Mitchell, who is the great living translator of German texts, and he just produced a new translation of Kafka's The Trial. And to discuss translation and the obligation a translator has to, number one, be faithful to the text on the one hand, but to make it accessible to the reader of today. And I believe it was Breon Mitchell who said, you know, one of the great paradoxes is that the original, the classic, always remains fresh, always remains alive in its original language, but the translation constantly needs to be tailored for its generation, which is why any number of editors or translators that I've interviewed, editors, let's say, of Shakespeare texts, will tell you that each generation needs its own edition of Shakespeare to be edited by scholars, that each generation should have its own Dante, each generation should have its own Cervantes, each generation should have its own Iliad or Odyssey, and it constantly needs to be refreshed for this new wave of readers. And I just found that a fascinating concept that everyone seems to agree on, in fact.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I went to the library yesterday and I took out Seamus Heaney's reading himself of his own translation of Beowulf.
Unbelievable. Now, that's
it
one of the great
really
stories,
marvelous.
Isn't it? Because as I quote Fagles on that, in fact, and he said, now that's a... He said he was far more impressed by Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf. He said, because that's a pretty snarly text, is the phrase he used. That's tough. Beowulf is the Iliad, the Odyssey. Well, of course, that's been with us forever. I mean, you talk about one text that just keeps resonating throughout the centuries. It's the writings of Homer. But how many translations of Beowulf could you cite, and what an effort that was by Seamus Heaney to translate it and to make it accessible to this contemporary readership, and do it so brilliantly, and to become a bestseller. When you think about it, that
really?
Beowulf became a bestseller.
Oh, that's marvelous. That kind of gives one hope.
It does give one hope, and when you think that Robert Fagles' books have sold more than 2 million copies. You know, people ask, are the classics relevant today? I cite the fact that the people who buy his translations of Homer certainly seem to think so.
Right. You know, you also quote Proust in saying that the duty and the task of the writer are those of the translator. I wonder if you could explain what he meant by that and talk about that a little bit.
Well, we're talking arguably here about the author of the great 20th century novel. If you poll the writers, and the canon is established by other writers, it's writers who keep texts alive. And I've seen.
And why don't you say what the canon means for
some of the
listeners?
Well, the canon. What is the canon? We're talking about canonical writings.
Would you say a canon is how a culture, the books that a culture chooses to define itself by?
I think that's a perfect definition. I wouldn't change that at all. Mm. But which sustain a culture, or even you have texts that have survived long after the cultures themselves have disappeared. You know, I mean, the Roman is no longer ancient Rome. I mean, you know, there are any number of epics. Or I mean, Beowulf, the Anglo-Saxon world doesn't exist, but yet their epic, the epic narrative from these various cultures does survive.
But you know, it almost seems, as you're talking, it occurs to me that you're really talking about human canon, not of any particular culture, although they are specific to culture, but that these are works that have inspired people across cultures.
I think so, and it's one of the avenues that we have, and in many cases the only avenue that we have into understanding these or penetrating these cultures, or getting some sense of not just what they were, but who they were. Because if there is one constant, it's human nature, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Human nature seems to remain the same over the centuries, which is one of the aspects that we do see when we read Homer or when we read Shakespeare, is one of the reasons we find what they write so illuminating and so brilliant is because of the exquisite sense of human nature that they have.
You know, I'd like to move now to some of the efforts that you delineate in the book to really bring this canon and to bring the love of reading to people who are not normally in that position to do that. And you talk about a wonderful PRISM project at Dartmouth and Dartmouth, Mass.
Yeah, well, it started down there. It's called Changing Lives Through Literature. And what is euphemistically called an alternative sentencing program. And this is, by the way, is not for first-time offenders. This isn't the slap on the wrist. This is for people who have been repeat offenders and who are about to go off to prison. You know, the ones that I write about were younger offenders, but young meaning like perhaps early 20s. But there are offenders who are perhaps in their 30s or their 40s, where they use reading as a device. They require them to take a course. They aren't required. They have to apply for it and be approved for it and to have some facility, have a good facility to read. I mean, this is not a program that teaches you how to read. This is not a literacy program. It's a literature program. And the feeling is that through literature you will change lives. And that is a theme of my book, I think, throughout. And I thought it was a very appropriate way to... It is the concluding segment of this book, which follows hard on the heels, by the way, of my Reach Out and Read segment. I thought that I would really try to end on a very triumphant note, which is reading in the 21st century with children. The pediatricians who have banded together throughout the United States, based also here in Massachusetts in Boston. I have this profile of Dr. Perry Class. She's the medical director of Reach Out and Read, and a fine writer and author in her own right. She's written 9 books. And this is where pediatricians have determined that reading, teaching reading to children, beginning at the age of 6 months, and making reading part of regular pediatric care is as important as food, as warmth, as nourishment. It's as essential to growth as any of these needs.
Every book, its reader, The Power of the Printed Word to Stir the World by Nicholas Bazbains. And thank you so much for coming and speaking on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure. And thank you for such wonderful questions.
That's author Nicholas Bazbains.
That's it for this week's show. Please join us next week when we talk with the editor of a marvelous new book for children called Poetry Speaks to Children. We'll also play cuts from the CD that comes with the book of poets reading their own poetry. Anyone who loves poetry
or children
won't want to miss this show.
And here's a sample from the CD of that book, Poetry Speaks to Children. Langston Hughes reading his wonderful poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
You've been listening to Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The show is produced with the able collaboration of my co-host, Daisy Mathias, and with the help of Jody Schneider. If you want to know more about Writer's Voice, please go to our website at www.writersvoice.net. There you can find a link to our podcast site in case you want to check out any of our archive shows that we've put up there. And if you want a copy of any of our shows, please email us at writersvoice@wmua.org.